Welcome to today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette and the Fort Dodge Messenger for Friday, April 19th, 2024. I'm your reader, Doug Kretzinger, and here is our first story from the Mason City Globe Gazette. Jurors picked for Trump case. First story up on the headlines. Court eyes alternates in first ever trial of former president. It's written by Michael R. Sizak, Jennifer Pelz, Eric Tucker, and Jake Offenhartz. It's an Associated Press article. Dateline is New York. A jury of 12 people was seated Thursday in former President Donald Trump's history-making hush money trial, propelling the proceedings closer to opening statements and the start of weeks of dramatic testimony. The court quickly turned to selecting alternate jurors. The jury includes a sales professional, a software engineer, a security engineer, an English teacher, a speech therapist, multiple lawyers, an investment banker, and a retired wealth manager. The first ever trial of a former American president will unfold in the middle of this year's race for the White House, ensuring that the legal troubles of the presumptive Republican nominee will be a dominant issue in the contest against Democratic incumbent Joe Biden. The trial will almost certainly feature unflattering testimony about Trump's personal life before he became president, with allegations that he falsified business records to suppress stories in the final days of the 2016 election about his sexual relationships. The jury selection process appeared wobbly earlier in the day when two jurors were dismissed, one after expressing doubt about her ability to be fair following disclosure of details about her identity, and the other over concerns that some of his answers in court might have been inaccurate. But lawyers who began the day with only five jurors settled on the remaining seven for the panel in quick succession, along with one alternate. Judge Juan Merchan says his goal is to have six apt alternates. In other developments, prosecutors asked for Trump to be held in contempt for a series of social media posts this week, and the judge barred reporters from identifying jurors' employers after expressing privacy concerns. The district attorney's office on Monday sought a $3,000 fine for Trump for three Truth Social posts they said violated the order. Since then, prosecutors said he made seven additional posts that they believe violate the order. The judge had already scheduled a hearing for next week on the prosecution's request for contempt sanctions over Trump's post. The hush money trial centers on a $130,000 payment that former Trump lawyer Michael Cohen made shortly before the 2016 election to porn actor Stormy Daniels to prevent her claims of a sexual encounter with Trump from becoming public in the race's final days. Prosecutors say Trump obscured the true nature of the payments in internal records when his company reimbursed Cohen, who pleaded guilty to federal charges in 2018 and is expected to be a star witness for the prosecution. Trump has denied having a sexual encounter with Daniels, and his lawyers argue that the payments to Cohen were legitimate legal expenses. Trump faces 34 felony counts of falsifying business records. He could get up to 4 years in prison if convicted, though it's not clear that the judge would opt to put him behind bars. Trump would almost certainly appeal any conviction. Appeals and legal wrangling have caused delays in the other three cases charging Trump with plotting to overturn the 2020 election results and with illegally hoarding classified documents. In the election interference case, Trump lost a bid Thursday to pause a string of lawsuits accusing him of inciting the U.S. Capitol attack. U.S. District Judge Amit Mehta in Washington denied defense lawyers' request to put the civil cases seeking to hold Trump responsible for the January 6, 2021 riot on hold, while the criminal case accusing him of conspiring to overturn his election defeat to President Joe Biden plays out. The jury selection process in the hush money case picked up momentum Tuesday with the selection of seven jurors. But on Thursday, Merchan revealed in court that one of the seven, a cancer nurse, conveyed that after sleeping on it overnight, she had concerns about her ability to be fair and impartial in this case. That was a quote. Though jurors' names are being kept confidential, the woman told the court she had doubts after she had aspects of her identity were made public. Yesterday alone, I had friends, colleagues, and family push things to my phone regarding questioning my identity as a juror, she said. I don't believe at this point that I can be fair and unbiased and let the outside influences not affect my decision-making in the courtroom, she said. A second seated juror was dismissed after prosecutors raised concerns that he may not have been honest in answering a jury selection question by saying that he was never accused or convicted of a crime. The IT professional was summoned to court to answer questions after prosecutors said they found an article about a person with the same name who was arrested in the 1990s for tearing down political posters pertaining to the political right in suburban Westchester County. Prosecutor also disclosed that a relative of the man may have been involved in a deferred prosecution agreement in the 1990s with the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, which is prosecuting Trump's case. Because the juror was questioned Thursday at the judge's bench, off microphone and out of earshot of reporters, it was not known whether the man confirmed or denied either instance was connected to him. After dismissing from the jury the nurse, who already was selected, Mershon ordered journalists to, in court, not to report prospective jurors' answers to questions about their current and former employers. We just lost probably what probably would have been a good juror, very good juror for this case, and the first thing that she said was she was afraid and intimidated by the press, all the press, and everything that had happened, Mershon said after dismissing the juror. Second story on the front page, headline, Trauma Shadows, Survivors of Columbine 25 Years Later. Aftershocks of Colorado school shooting take its toll, even for those not physically hurt. It's written by Colleen Sleben of the Associated Press, and the dateline is Denver. Hours after she escaped the Columbine High School shooting, 14-year-old Missy Mendo slept between her parents in bed, still wearing the shoes she had on when she fled her math class. She wanted to be ready to run. 25 years later, and with Mendo now a mother herself, the trauma from that horrific day remains close on her heels. It caught up to her when 60 people were shot dead in 2017 at a music festival in Las Vegas, a city she visited a lot while working in the casino industry. Then again in 2022, when 19 students and two teachers were shot and killed in Uvalde, Texas. Mendo was filling out her daughter's pre-kindergarten application when news of the elementary school shooting broke. She read a few lines of a news story about Uvalde, then put her head down and cried. It felt like nothing changed, she recalls thinking. In the quarter century since two gunmen at Columbine shot and killed 12 fellow students, and a teacher in the suburban Denver, an attack that played out on live television and ushered in the modern era of school shootings, the traumas of that day have continued to shadow Mendo and others who were there. Some needed years to view themselves as Columbine survivors since they were not physically wounded, yet things like fireworks could still trigger disturbing memories. The aftershocks, often acknowledged in the years before mental health struggles were more widely recognized, led to some survivors suffering insomnia, dropping out of school, or disengaging from their spouses or families. Survivors and other members of the community plan to attend a candlelight vigil on the steps of the state capitol Friday night, the eve of the shooting's anniversary. April is particularly hard for Mendo, 39, whose brain turns to mashed potatoes each year. She shows up at dentist appointments early, misplaces her keys, forgets to close the refrigerator door. She leans on therapy and the understanding of an expanding group of shooting survivors she met through the Rebels Project, a support group founded by other Columbine survivors after a 2012 shooting when a gunman killed 12 people at a movie theater in the nearby suburb of Aurora. Mendo started seeing a therapist after her child's first birthday, at the urging of fellow survivor moms. After she broke down over Uvalde, Mendo, a single parent, said she talked to her mom, took a walk to get some fresh air, then finished her daughter's pre-K application. Was I afraid of her going into the public school system? Absolutely, she said of her daughter. Researchers who've studied the long-term effects of gun violence in schools have quantified protracted struggles among survivors, including long-term academic effects like absenteeism and reduced college enrollment and lower earnings later in life. Just counting lives lost is kind of an incorrect way to capture the full cost of these tragedies, said Maya Rawson Slater, an associate professor in the Standard University School of Medicine's Department of Health Policy. Mass killings have recurred with numbing frequency in the years since Columbine, with almost 600 attacks in which four or more people have died, not including the perpetrator. Since 2006, according to data compiled by the Associated Press. More than 80% of the 3,045 victims in those attacks were killed by a firearm. Nationwide, hundreds of thousands of people have been exposed to school shootings that are often not mass casualty events but still traumatic, Rawson Slater said. The impacts can last a lifetime, she added, resulting in kind of a persistent reduced potential for survivors, she said. Those who were present at Columbine say the years have since given them time to learn more about what happened to them and how to cope with it. Heather Martin, now 42, was a Columbine senior in 1999. In college, she began crying during a fire drill, realizing later that a fire alarm had gone off for 3 hours when she and 60 other students hid in a barricaded office during the high school shooting. She couldn't return to that class and was marked absent each time, and says she failed it after refusing to write a final paper on school violence, despite telling her professor of her experience at Columbine. It took 10 years for her to see herself as a survivor, after she was invited back with the rest of the class of 1999 for an anniversary event. She saw fellow classmates having similar struggles and decided to go back to college to become a teacher. Martin, a co-founder of the Rebels Project, named after Columbine's mascot, said 25 years has given her time to struggle and figure out how to work out those struggles. I just know myself so well now and know how I respond to things and what might activate me and how I can bounce back and be okay. And most importantly, I think I can recognize when I am not okay and when I do need to seek help, she said. I'm finding no local stories, folks, so I'm going to jump to page 3 here. And I want to begin with this article. It says, UAE struggles with floodwaters. Heaviest rainfall ever recorded impairs busy airport in desert nation. Written by John Gambrell, Associated Press. Dubai is the headline, is the dateline. The United Arab Emirates tried to wring itself out Thursday after the heaviest recorded rainfall ever hit the desert nation, with its main airport allowing more flights even as floodwater still covered portions of major highways and communities. Dubai International Airport, the world's busiest for international travel, allowed global carriers on Thursday morning to again fly into Terminal 1 at the airfield. Long-haul carrier Emirates, crucial to east-west travel, began allowing local passengers to arrive at Terminal 3, their base of operations. However, Dubai Airport's CEO Paul Griffiths said in an interview with the Associated Press that the airfield needed at least another 24 hours to resume operations close to its usual schedule. Meanwhile, one desert community in Dubai saw floodwaters continue to rise Thursday to as much as 3 feet as civil defense officials struggled to pump out the water. We were looking at the radar thinking, goodness, if this hits, then it's going to be cataclysmic, Griffin said of the storm, and indeed it was, he said. The airport ended up needing 22 tankers with vacuum pumps to get water off its grounds. Griffiths acknowledged that taxiways flooded during the rains, though the airport's runways remained free of water to safely operate. Online videos of a Fly Dubai flight landing with its reverse thrust spraying out water caught the world's attention. The UAE, a hereditarily ruled autocratic nation on the Arabian Peninsula, typically sees little rainfall in its arid desert climate. However, a massive storm forecasters warned about 4 days blew through the country's seven sheikdoms. By the end of Tuesday, more than 5.59 inches of rainfall soaked Dubai over 24 hours. An average year sees 3.73 inches of rain at Dubai International Airport. Other areas of the country saw even more precipitation. On Thursday, people waded through oil-slick floodwater to reach cars, checking to see if their engines still ran. Tanker trucks with vacuums began reaching some areas outside of Dubai's downtown core for the first time as well. Meanwhile, intense floods also struck neighboring Oman in recent days. Authorities on Thursday raised the death toll from those storms to at least 12 killed. Right below that story is this one. This is NATO. EU leaders urge G7 to boost aid to Kyiv. Top officials say the Ukrainian power grid could depend on it. It's an Associated Press article. Dateline is Capri, Italy. Top NATO and European Union officials urge foreign ministers from leading industrialized nations on Thursday to take quick, concrete steps to provide more air defense systems and artillery to Ukraine, warning that continued delays could tilt the war in Moscow's favor. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg and EU Foreign Policy Chief Joseph Borrell addressed foreign ministers of G7 nations meeting on the Italian resort island of Capri. Russia's war on Ukraine and surging tensions in the Middle East over Iran's unprecedented attack on Israel over the weekend topped the agenda of the gathering. Without more Patriot air defense missile systems to protect against Russian strikes, the electricity system of Ukraine will be destroyed, and no country can fight without having electricity at home, in the factories, in the front line, Borrell told reporters on the sidelines of the event. Stoltenberg welcomed signs that the U.S. Congress might soon vote on a $61 billion aid package for Ukraine, the bulk of which would go to purchasing weapons and ammunition from U.S. defense manufacturers. And then right next to that is this article, headline, U.S., U.K. issue new round of sanctions after attack. Iran launched assault on Israel as fear grows of wider regional war. It's an Associated Press article. Dateline is Washington. The U.S. and U.K. on Thursday imposed a new round of sanctions on Iran as concern grows that Tehran's unprecedented attack on Israel could fuel a wider war in the Middle East. Sanctions are meant to hold Iran accountable for its weekend attack and to deter further such activity. The practical impact is likely to be limited because many of the targeted companies already were subject to U.S. sanctions and individuals singled out, for new sanctions are unlikely to have assets in U.S. jurisdictions. President Joe Biden said in a statement that he directed U.S. Treasury to continue, quote, to continue to impose sanctions that further degrade Iran's military industries. Let it be clear to all those who enable or support Iran's attacks, he said. He continued, we will not hesitate to take all necessary action to hold you accountable, end quote. Iowa's attack on Israel early Sunday came in, Iran's attack on Israel early Sunday came in response to what it says was an Israeli strike on Iran's consulate in Syria this month. Israel's military chief said Monday that his country will respond to the Iranian attack while world leaders caution against retaliation, trying to avoid a spiral of violence. Here are a few stories briefly. The Biden administration finalized a new rule Thursday to put conservation on more equal footing with industries on government-owned properties. Republican members of Congress said they will seek to invalidate the rule. Electric vehicle maker Tesla's stock tumbled below $150 per share Thursday, giving up all of the gains it made over the past year as it reels from falling sales and steep discounts intended to lure more buyers. And in Haiti, the Biden administration sent about 50 Haitians back to their country Thursday, authorities said, the first deportation flight in several months to the Caribbean nation struggling with surging gang violence. In Ohio, part of Ohio's capital, Columbus, was evacuated for hours Thursday out of fear that a fire in a truck's trailer might cause lithium-ion batteries to explode, but no injuries were reported. And with syphilis cases in U.S. newborns skyrocketing, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists recommended Thursday that all pregnant patients be screened 3 times for the sexually transmitted infection. And firings. Google confirmed late Wednesday it fired 28 employees after protest over technology the company is supplying to the Israeli government amid the Gaza war, escalating tensions around a $1.2 billion contract signed in 2021. I'm going to turn to sports here for a moment. For you hockey fans, NHL, here's an article on Associated Press. Cup playoffs appear wide open. General Manager Don Waddell likes how his Carolina Hurricanes finished the season, winning 16 of their final 21 games. He knows it means nothing now. Your points get erased and you all start with zeros, Waddell said. Playoffs are a different time. That's what's great about the NHL. Once you get to the playoffs, it's wide open, he said. This year, more than many in the recent past, and unlike last year, when Boston broke league records for the most wins and points in a season, there is no clear favorite to hoist the Stanley Cup. Carolina, Florida, defending champion Vegas, Dallas, Winnipeg, Edmonton, and the league-best New York Rangers are among the many contenders who could be the last team standing in June. I don't think there's that separation, former player turned TNT analyst Ed Ozek said. I think that there is 8 or 9 or 10 teams that I really feel could win the Stanley Cup, he said. Carolina, which opens against the New York Islanders, are 13-2 Cup favorites, according to MGM Sportsbook, followed by Florida, 7-1, Dallas, 15-2, Colorado, Edmonton, and the Rangers, all 8-1, Boston, 11-1, Vegas, 12-1, to repeat, and Toronto, 14-1. The Canucks and Jets are listed at 15-1, and 2020-21 Cup-winning Tampa Bay is 25-1, even with top goaltender Andre Vasilevsky rounding back into form. He's at his best when the games are on the line, and we look for that once again this year, 2020 playoff MVP Victor Hedman said. It's obviously so fun to have the best goalie in the world behind you when the playoffs start. Here's an article written by Emma Nelson of Minneapolis Star Tribune. It's personal finance. Costly invites is the headline of it. Weddings are all allegedly the happiest day of your life if you're a bride or groom. If you're a guest or in the wedding party, though, and this is your fourth wedding of the summer with your sister's nuptials coming up in the fall and a best friend is getting hitched on New Year's Eve, the elation might have slowly drained away like all the dollars from your bank account. The average wedding guest spends $611 per wedding they attend, according to 2023 Bank Rate Survey. At the same time, 22% of adults have no emergency savings, and the numbers are even higher for younger generations in their prime wedding guest years. That mismatch can create a financial hardship for people that'll extend past that celebratory day, said Jamia Erickson, a senior financial advisor at Thrivent Financial. If you're trying to manage the balancing act of supporting your friends and family on their big day without going into financial ruin, or you want to make your wedding day affordable for all invitees, here's some advice on how to celebrate responsibly. Emily Forrest Skernick, director of communications at wedding planning company Zola, said guests should feel free to depart from traditional norms governing wedding attendance. Things like how much you're supposed to spend on a gift, that you have to wear a new outfit, or that it is impolite to decline an invitation. Everyone who's getting married and everyone who's attending weddings is living in the reality of an economy where we can't all afford to do everything, Forrest Skernick said. It's okay to really, realistically, look at the wedding invites that you've received or that you think you're going to receive for the next year, and what your budget is and how much you really can afford to spend on weddings. The key is to plan and plan early, Erickson said. Create a budget for each wedding, taking into account ancillary costs, like the bachelorette party or going out after the reception. It's okay to say yes to some parts of the event and no to others. Explore cost-saving measures. Airline miles and hotel points can come in handy. So can coordinating with friends to share expenses. There are likely other guests facing the same constraints, Erickson said. During the wedding boom that followed the height of the COVID-19 pandemic, Julie France and her husband were invited to 5 weddings in a single year. They made it to all 5, but found ways to maximize their spending. As wedding guests, count the cost before you commit, said France, owner of Everyday Etiquette, a company that conducts presentations on manners and social skills. You have to do it based on relationships, the closeness that you have to particular people, and then the financial component to that, she said. If you are able to attend, France said, RSVP as soon as possible, preferably within 24 hours of receiving the invite. If you were invited to be in the wedding party, you can take more time to decide. Once you've thanked the couple for the invitation, explained your situation, respond to them as soon as possible with a definite answer. If the answer is yes, only death or severe illness should prevent you from attending, France said. If the answer is no, she recommends sending a handwritten note with an offer to celebrate with the couple after their honeymoon. Though you're not obligated to send a gift, she said, it's good form to do so, though it doesn't have to be expensive. The couple bears responsibility, France said, for either making their wedding accessible to guests or accepting that some might not be able to attend. Guests should feel free to go in together on a larger gift or buy something off registry, France said. The intent of weddings is, and should be, you're having this amazing commitment ceremony, and you want those people that mean a lot to you to be there, and it shouldn't have anything to do with money, France said. A wedding is not a fun. When building a registry, Forrest Skernick said couples should include items at a range of price points. Often, the most memorable gifts are not the most expensive. For everyone involved in the big day, honesty is key, with others and with yourself. As a guest, it can be easy to just swipe your credit card, Erickson said, but it's important to consider the long-term consequences for your finances and the other things you want to accomplish. It's really taking a true self-evaluation to see if it's in your best interest to attend, Erickson said, and if it's not, you may have to say no and send that gift card and wish them well and try to connect with them afterward. You are listening to the Mason City Globe Gazette and Fort Dodge Messenger on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Doug Kretzinger. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, give us a call, 515-243-6833. And now we're going to turn to the Fort Dodge Messenger on this Friday, April 19th, 2024. The headline on the front page, Acting Out. FDSH students have strong speech season. It's written by Chris Johnson. And it reads, the fine arts students at Fort Dodge Senior High School are headed into another project preparing for the school's 97th annual musical, but are coming off a banner season on the speech stage. The last couple of years, I didn't think our team could get any bigger, said speech coach Lindy Krug. But I was proven wrong. We were fortunate to continue working with our veteran team members while adding more at each grade level, and the freshman class came out in droves. I can't wait to continue to see them all grow over the next few years, she said. Fort Dodge Speech had a strong season competing in large group and individual speech. 4 Dodger groups earned all-state honors after a large contingent had strong performances at the state level. During state competition, Fort Dodge received 21 Division I ratings and 2 Division II ratings. Students who were selected for all-state either performed in Ames or earned all-state status. Performing for their short film was A.J. Abert, let's see if I can get this, Abdura Kanov, Jasmine Dillard, Tiffany Garber, Leif Hamilton, Logan Hamilton, Owen Hamlow, Parker Hansen, Chris Hasselbus, Jocelyn Kaler, and Lacey Larson. Bowie Sanders performed a rendition of Solo Me. Sydney Gebbers and Michael Wagner were named All-State for their ensemble acting. Abby Cassiato, Emma Conley, Mina Jajong, Kalia Jensen, Raina Prado, Simeon Roberts, and Ali Utley got the nod for Reader's Theater. "We've had a record year for speech," said Krug. "We had a wonderful large group contest season. Over 90 students competed in 23 events at the Large Group District Speech Contest. 21 of those qualified for state contest, our highest percentage of qualifiers. 4 of those events were given the distinction of All-State. 4 individual speech Fort Dodge received, 11 All-State selections, 8 of them competing in Cedar Falls. Over 60 students competed at the state competition, earning 50 Division I ratings and 10 Division II ratings. Not only do we have the numbers, the talent is there too," King Krug said. "In fact, I wholeheartedly believe that Fort Dodge is a fine arts town. I've heard from many people who aren't native to Fort Dodge that they can't believe the concentration of talented artists we have in this area," he said. Performing at the All-State Showcase was Aiden Recker, Radio News announcing, Ollie Utley, Literary Program, Anna Lawrence, Prose, Chloe Baum, Poetry, Grant Behrens, Spontaneous Speaking, Katie Dawson, Radio News announcing, Amina DeJong, Literary Program, and Owen Hamlow, Public Address. Earning all state status were Alexa McCone, Prose, Grant Behrens, Storytelling, and Michael Wagner, Solo Musical Theater. "The same can be said for our individual contest season," Krug said. "We started with 60 events, the most events we've taken to district individual contest performed by 52 students and 50 of those qualified, which was also a record. 11 of those competitors were given the All-State honor, which was also a record." Krug was proud of the way the students compared. Again, Krug was proud of the way the students competed and were able to get better each time out. I couldn't be more proud of my students and my fellow coaches, Amber Rouse and Ashley Frederick," Krug said. "It is a grueling schedule to keep up with, and they all put their hearts and souls into it. Alumni, many of whom come back and volunteer coach and the community." Continuing on page one, new law closes gap in eligibility for veterans benefits. Bravovich. Governor Kim Reynolds signed a bill Thursday that she said would help deliver services to military veterans and close a gap in eligibility for some Iowans with service-related disabilities. She signed House File 259 during a conference of County Veterans Affairs Commissioners and Leaders in Johnston. The bill addresses training and requirements for county commissioners, executive directors, and administrators. It passed both chambers of the legislature with no opposition. At the state level, it's our duty to help veterans identify early benefits that they're eligible for and access all the services that are due to them. And that's really exactly what House File 259 aims to do, Reynolds said. And it's my hope that this bill will also help us increase the number of benefits Iowa veterans receive. The bill expands the definition of veteran to include a resident of the state who served in any component of the U.S. Armed Forces who has a service-connected disability and was honorably discharged. This closes a gap in current code to ensure men and women who were injured in training but do not meet the active duty requirement are eligible for veteran services, Reynolds said. And Otho Fireman's Ball is nearing. It's written by Bill Shea. Fundraiser is set for April 27. An upcoming event will allow people to dance the night away and win prizes while raising money for a local volunteer fire department. The 21st annual Otho Fireman's Ball will begin at 5 p.m. April 27 at the Webster County Fairgrounds south of Fort Dodge on Old Highway 169. Admission is $10 for adults, $6 for children, and tickets can be purchased at the door or from any Otho firefighter. We always have a good time, Fire Chief Marty Smith said. We've got a great auction lined up, and we have food from Amigos, which is always good. Everyone always has a good time at the fairgrounds. Dwayne Murley will be the event's DJ, providing music until midnight. A meal prepared by Amigos of Fort Dodge will be served from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. An auction will begin at 6 p.m. There will be two door prizes, one for adults and one for kids. A six-piece patio furniture set is a prize for the adults. A $100 Fort Frenzy gift card is the prize for the kids. There will also be two raffle prizes, a $250 gift certificate to Fairway, and a $250 gift certificate to Hy-Vee. Proceeds from the ball are used to buy equipment. And the next story on the page, pipe supplier sues Summit Carbon Solutions for $15 million. This is written by Jared Strong. An Arkansas pipe manufacturer is seeking more than $15 million from a company that wants to build a carbon dioxide pipeline system in Iowa amid delays of their agreement, according to a lawsuit filed this week. The lawsuit filed by Wellspun Tubular says Summit Carbon Solutions commissioned the company to produce about 785 miles of pipe starting in May of 2023 at a total cost of about $183 million. But Summit's project, a 2,500-mile pipeline network in five states, has taken longer to get potential approval than the company initially anticipated. It now says construction might begin early next year. A purchase agreement between the two companies allowed Summit to delay pipe production for up to 6 months until November of 2023, according to the lawsuit complaint filed in state court in Delaware, where Wellspun is incorporated. Wellspun was able to further delay the start of production to early 2024 by manufacturing pipe for others, to which Summit agreed, court records show. But when Wellspun notified Summit that it planned to proceed with production in February, Summit sought to delay again, according to the lawsuit. Summit asked to discuss the status of the project, and those discussions revealed that the project was dramatically off schedule, the lawsuit said. In February, Summit canceled the agreement, according to the lawsuit. Wellspun claims that entitles it to a $15 million cancellation charge and partial reimbursement for materials it obtained to manufacture the pipe. Summit disagrees that it owes the money and hopes to find a compromise. Our current dispute with Wellspun Tubular resolves around timing issues related to pipe delivery, the company said in a prepared statement. We're committed to resolving this matter swiftly, and our intention to collaborate with Wellspun remains unchanged. Summit's $8.5 billion pipeline system would transport captured carbon dioxide from ethanol plants to North Dakota for underground sequestration. The Iowa Utilities Board is poised to decide whether to issue the company a hazardous liquid pipeline permit. State regulators in North and South Dakota rejected the company's initial pipeline routes. North Dakota is reconsidering a revised plan, and Summit has said it intends to file a new permit request in South Dakota. Headline reads, FDCSD named Students Employee of the Month for April. The Fort Dodge Community School District has named the April 2024 Students and Employee of the Month honorees. Program recognizes one elementary, one middle school, and one high school student, as well as one staff member, monthly, for exceeding expectations. Peyton Ahrens is the Elementary Student of the Month. Andrew Turpin nominated Ahrens, writing, Peyton is a very hard worker and is willing to try things even when they are really hard. She thinks outside the box and uses the strategies she knows work for her. When Peyton finds a topic she is interested in, she will try to learn as much as possible as she can about the topic. End quote. And Turpin also wrote, Peyton is incredibly kind-hearted and caring towards both adults and students. She is aware of how her actions impact others and acts appropriately. She works amazingly with every student and is a positive role model for everyone in the school, he said, Turpin said. He concluded his nomination with, She will speak up when things aren't right and have a solution for problems that may arise. She will work with everyone and is respectful and kind to everyone, he said. Eliana Yeoman is the middle school student of the month. The Six Blue team nominated her. In their nomination, they wrote, Eliana is always engaged in lessons and clarifies her learning when needed. She will ask extra questions and will go out of her way to help other students. Elena is willing to put in extra work because success is important to her. Overall, Elena loves to learn, and it is obvious in all of her classes. Elena exhibits our core beliefs on a daily basis. She is kind and respectful to her peers and adults. She wants all students to feel like they belong, and her actions show her good character daily. This carries over to experiences outside of school. Eliana participates in multiple activities, and her interactions enrich the lives of others. They concluded their nomination by writing, Eliana is a perfect example of displaying the Dodger way at all times, regardless of her environment or who she is surrounded by. She stays true to herself, which is a pretty amazing person. Ella Champagne is the Senior High Student of the Month. Kevin Yeoman nominated her, writing, Ella wants to become a special education teacher, so she has been coming into my room daily to learn more about the job. She does an excellent job of interacting with all of the students in my classroom and works one-on-one with each of them when able. She is always in a good mood and kind to everyone she interacts with. Ella displays caring for other students and seems to genuinely care about bringing out the best in others. She makes each of my students feel valued. Sarah Blowers is the Employee of the Month. Jen Cordle nominated her by writing, Sarah goes above and beyond to make sure her team makes data-driven decisions, yet she also recognizes the individual needs of her students. She develops strong relationships with her kindergarten students while holding high expectations for herself, her team, and her students. Sarah has been a member of the Lighthouse team and a facilitator of the leadership team at the Early Childhood Center for 3 years. This year, with the restructuring of the Leader in Me teams, she put in countless hours preparing our family engagement events. She put in many behind-the-scenes hours analyzing data, coordinating with team members, and communicating with staff and families to ensure our building held 2 successful events to inform families in an engaging atmosphere. An area where Sarah Blowers recently really shines is the way she forms relationships with her students and creates a culture of caring and learning in her classroom. She sets clear expectations for her students and provides consistency. She does an excellent job of being her best for her students every day. She is a leader in the classroom and in the building. And it's spelled B-L-O-W-E-R-S, Blowers or Blowers. Hope I got that right. And on page 6 of the Messenger, there's a lot of pictures here and a few titles underneath them. I'm going to read it for you. Robotics demonstration at Duncombe. And it's got here a picture of four Fort Dodge Senior High students demonstrated robotics to 5th grade students at Duncombe Elementary on Thursday. And is there? You can see there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of them there. 2 of them are making these robots move. And you go over here to right next to that, there's a picture of Jazera Huff. She's 11. She participates in a demonstration for robotics on Thursday at Duncombe Elementary. She's excited. She's having a good time. And we go over here to Serena. There's a picture here of 2 people. Serena Arleno, 11, left, and Kays Berkey, 16. They craft plans for a new robot on Thursday at the elementary school. And then there's one over here, Katie Parker, and she is 15. She teaches Rosewater Lemus, 11, how robotics works on Thursday at the elementary school. And it looks like they're doing a good job. That's just some idea of what's going on. The whole page is filled with those pictures and that story. Those folks are learning about robotics. We have 3 short obituaries today in the paper. Della Davids of Kanawha. Della Davis is 100, was 104, passed away April 15. Ewing Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. If you want to know more, it's ewingfh.com. Doug Crimmins, 69, of Fort Dodge, passed away Wednesday the 17th. He was at his home. A mass of Christian burial will be at 11 a.m. Monday, April 22nd, at Holy Trinity Church. A visitation will be 1 hour prior at the church. Burial will be at a later date at the Iowa Veterans Cemetery, Van Meter. Loffersweiler Funeral Home is serving the family. And Robert Bob Ashe, A-S-C-H-E, of Eagle Grove. Visitation will be Monday, April 22, from 5 to 7 p.m. at Faust Funeral Home in Eagle Grove, foustfh.com for more information. Moving into the sports section now for Friday, April 19. Headline is Area Runners Shine in FD, Fort Dodge. Dodgers, Gales, Humboldt, Manson, Northwest Webster, all in action at Dodger Relays. Excuse me. And this one is written by Chris Johnson. It says the Fort Dodge girls didn't earn any first-place finishes at the 43rd Annual Dodger Relays on Thursday at J.H. Nitzke Track, but they continued to show steady improvement. The Dodgers finished 6th with 81.5 points. Mason City, 125, was the champion, followed by St. Edmund, 121.5, and Forest City, 117.5. I knew we had a possible shot at getting as high as 4th, said FDSH head coach Todd Constable. The girls ran extremely hard. It's always good to host the Dodger Relays. Senior Mackenzie McElrath had a pair of top three finishes. McElrath was second in the high jump with a leap of 4.10. She finished behind Forest City's Lexi Isbrand, 5.0. McElrath placed third in the 400-meter hurdles at 1.815.85. Humboldt's Sophia Harris, 114.62, was the 400 hurdles champion. It's important for people to know how much Mackenzie works, Constable said. People don't realize how good of an athlete she is and how great of a student she is. All of our seniors, Mackenzie, Carson Zare, Macy Brown, and Lily Davis, have really been tremendous, he said. The Dodgers 4x100 quartet of Annalise Schur, Hope Alstott, Mish McCaleb, and Ava Wessels took silver in the 4x100 in 54.09. Forest City, 52.27, won the event. They wanted to know what they needed for Drake in the 4x1, and we knew it was a low 52, Constable said. They were pretty bummed they didn't qualify, but we just want to keep getting better and peak in a couple of weeks. We are starting to get back to full strength. Freshman Maddie Hoshaw also brought home a bronze medal in the 200. She crossed the tape in 28.68, just behind Forest City's Colette Loges, 28.43. Mason City's Latasha York, 27.67, was the winner. Maddie is an outstanding athlete. It's going to be fun watching her progress, Constable said. She has a bright future. We have 3 more years to see her develop. The sprint medley squad of Schur, Alstott, Wessels, and Lucy Porter was third, 204.05. Kai Mariana Mosley was fourth in both the shot put, 31-3, and discus, 96-0. The distance medley quartet of Wessels, Hoshaw, Lily Davis, and Carson Zare, 4.49.75, was also fourth. Melina Meyer took fourth in the 100-meter hurdles, 17.77. Davis, Hoshaw, Porter, and McElrath, 4.29.76, were fourth in the 4x400. We couldn't have such a great meet without all of our volunteers, Constable said. Boys, coaches Kevin Astor, Nick Moser, and Sam Moser helped a lot. Starter Fran Long runs a tremendous race and does such a smooth job transitioning. It's efficient, and there is not much downtime. Josh Smith works our automatic timing system, FDSH Athletic and Activities Director. Mr. Brandon Ruffage helps us put on a great meet. This well-assembled staff has been a welcome asset for a 35-year-old franchise that hasn't had many of them. One of many strengths the Timberwolves bring to the NBA playoffs this spring as the number 3 seed in the Western Conference. Finch is a strong contender for the Coach of the Year award after steering the Timberwolves to a... And folks, I just jumped into another story. I am so sorry. I'm going to go back here. And that other story we had ends with Josh Smith works out our automatic timing system. FDSH Athletic and Activity Director, Mr. Brandon Ruffridge, helps us put a great meet. So that ends that story. And I accidentally jumped to another story here in the Sports Roundup. Horn, double winner for Gales. And Dateline is Jewel. Hunter Horn scored a pair of first-place finishes, and the St. Edmund boys were sixth overall here Thursday at the Hawk Relays. Hampton Dumont, Cal, won team gold by 3 points over Des Moines Christian, as Garner, Hayfield, Ventura, Roland Story, and South Hamilton rounded out the top five. The Gales were just 11 points back of Garner, Hayfield, Ventura. Horn won both the high jump and the 400 hurdles as Anthony Valls joined him with a victory in the 800. Both are sophomores. Horn cleared 5'6" and went 1.00.65 for his winning marks, while Valls posted a 2.17.06. Valls was also the 3,200 runner-up, finished third in the 1,600. Hunter's really coming along, SEHS head coach Don Larson said. It was great to see him perform like he did. Even running in a heavy wind, he was close to a PR in the hurdles. Overall, it was a good night for the guys. We were missing a few, so we didn't run a couple relays, but we really ran hard and competed. Aaron Hint earned a bronze in the long jump and was sixth in the 100, with Levi Oder Westrom placing fourth in the 800. Leo N, 400, and Thomas Cosgrove, 400 hurdles, each placed fifth. Clay Baker was seventh in the 200, as Liam Shannon, 3,200, Jacob Koopman, 1,600, each finished eighth. Four players were in the top five for the Gales, with the sprint medley and 4x400 each placing third. The sprint medley consisted of Cosgrove, Grant Gales, Baker, and Leo N. Cosgrove, Baker, Gales, and Hint participated in the 4x400. The 4x200 of Cosgrove, Gales, Koopman, and Horn finished fourth, with the 4x800 of Koopman, Horn, Thomas Kenobi, and Oder Westrom taking fifth. St. Edmund returns to action on Tuesday when they travel to Manson. Well, folks, this brings us to the end of today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette and the Fort Dodge Messenger. I'm your reader, Doug Kretzinger. I want to thank you for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind, and I wish you a good day. Thank you.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is EarthDate. A decade ago, there were typically 20 earthquakes a year that were large enough to feel in the central and eastern U.S. But in 2015, there were over 1,000 of them. Why? It's mostly because we're pumping more water into the ground. The boom in U.S. oil and gas production over the last decade has brought many more oil wells, which also produce water. Most is naturally occurring in the formation, and some was injected by operators to allow or improve the recovery of oil and gas. In both cases, the water will likely have picked up salt and other minerals from the rock, making it many times saltier than seawater. Operators may re-inject this water to continue to liberate oil and gas. But more often, there's too much to handle. So it's trucked or piped to disposal wells, where it's pumped down into deep saltwater reservoirs. Adding large volumes of wastewater increases the pressure in these rock formations, which can allow natural faults to slip more easily than they normally would, causing earthquakes. To address these quakes, regulators and the petroleum industry are monitoring disposal wells and shutting down those that could cause damaging seismic activity. And they now think that managing wastewater injection more carefully should help. There's still more work to be done, and university research centers, like the Bureau of Economic Geology, are conducting major studies with the aim of minimizing the risk of earthquakes while maintaining the benefits of domestic energy production. For EarthDate, I'm Scott Tinker.
EarthDate is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more EarthDate stories at earthdate.org.